The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, Should You Use Native American or American Indian? That depends on who you ask. According to the National Congress of American Indians, NCAI, there are 574 federally recognized Indian nations, variously called tribes, nations, bands, pueblos, communities, and native villages, in the United States, in addition to hundreds of sovereign tribal nations. Per census data released in 2021, the number of people who self-identified as solely Native American and Alaska Native in 2020 was 3.7 million. In combination with one or more races, that number jumps to 9.7 million. Given the mammoth cultural diversity across the population, there's no single answer to questions like, what do Native Americans call themselves, or is American Indian preferred? That said, there are terms that should definitely be avoided, and as is the case with the Hispanic versus Latino terminology debate, which comes with its own complex socio-geographic history, deferring to how people choose to define themselves is always best. For thousands of years before the U.S. was founded by European immigrants, Christopher Columbus, the most famous among them, the current nation members' ancestors inhabited what we now call North America. Each Indian nation's culture is uniquely shaped by its history, original languages, beliefs, and its members' past and current relationship to land they once held, or in some cases still hold, claim to. Similarly, every person of Native American descent is shaped by that history in addition to their personal experiences regionally, whether or not they live on a reservation or identify as a citizen of a particular tribe. Below, a high-level look at a complicated topic, the terms American Indian versus Native American versus Indigenous. To learn more, check out some Native American authors for a wealth of perspectives, or dip your toe into the world of the hashtag Native TikTok tag on the popular social app, and see why some celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day every October as opposed to Columbus Day, which pays tribute to the figure most associated with colonizing Indigenous land in the U.S. The preference between using Native American or American Indian is personal. Both terms are generally acceptable according to the National Museum of the American Indian, or NMAI, a Smithsonian institution based in both New York and Washington, D.C. In the United States, Native American has been widely used, but is falling out of favor with some groups, and the terms American Indian or Indigenous American are preferred by many Native people, an FAQ on the museum site explains. In its 2019 Tribal Nations and the United States report, the National Congress of American Indians defined Native American as all Native people of the United States and its trust territories, i.e. American Indians, Alaska Natives, Native Hawaiians, Chamorros, and American Samoans, as well as persons from Canadian First Nations and Indigenous communities in Mexico and Central and South America who are U.S. residents. The term Native American grew out of the political movements of the 1960s and 70s and is commonly used in legislation covering the indigenous people of the lower 48 states and U.S. territories. Kevin Gover, NMAI director and citizen of the Pawnee Tribe of Oklahoma, wrote in a 2017 Washington Post op-ed, but Native Americans use a range of words to describe themselves and all are appropriate. Gover goes on to explain that you'll also see people identify as Native, Indian, or Indigenous in the U.S., while in Canada, First Nations and First Peoples are most commonly used. The consensus, however, is that whenever possible, Native people prefer to be called by their specific tribal name, the NMAI site notes. That specifically matters to some because it's a way of honoring the culture that predated European colonizers' arrival. Many Native Americans identify as our tribes in our own languages. Allie Young, citizen of the Navajo Nation and founder of nonprofit Protect the Sacred, tells Oprah Daily. For example, I prefer Diné, which means the people in our language, over Navajo, which is a Spanish name given to us by those who colonized our communities. According to Young, there are movements within tribal communities across the U.S. to restore the original tribal names and make them the norm. Some people prefer to be identified by their clan. In addition to tribal affiliation, other things a Native person may consider part of their self-identification include sharing a regional language or their roots in a specific clan within a larger tribe, which shares its own inherited culture. The other way we identify ourselves as Diné people is by our clans and clanship system. We call this Ke'e, meaning family and kinship, Young says. Every Diné person's first clan is their mother's clan, which is also their maternal grandmother's clan and so on, passed down matrilineally. My mother's clan is Tatsof, which means big water, so I am big water, born from my father's clan, our second clan, To'ani, which means near the water people. Young is always interested in learning about fellow Diné people's clans. This demonstrates the value of Ke'e in our communities, because when we know how we're related to one another, we understand the importance of interconnectedness, she says, and we maintain solidarity, generosity, culture, and balance. When we have a grasp on these concepts, we are better relatives to one another, and we act with compassion and love. The U.S. Census uses the term American Indian. The U.S. Census has been combining American Indian or Alaska Native into one identity since 2000, making the precise number of indigenous people living in the lower 48 states impossible to come by. The Census Bureau believes it undercounted the number living on reservations by 4.9% in 2010. In a joint decision by the Bureau and tribal groups, it was decided that the 2020 census would continue to allow people to self-identify their tribal affiliations as a write-in under the race section. The massive population jump in those who self-identified as AIAN in the 2020 census is likely the result of multiple factors, including an overall increase in families identifying as multiracial. But Yvette Robidoux, Research Policy Director for the National Congress of American Indians, told CNN that it may actually be an undercount, given how difficult it can be to reach reservation residents who don't have USPS mailing addresses, landlines, and/or access to broadband internet. Avoid the term Indian if you are non-Indigenous, not least because it's confusing. While Merriam-Webster still secondarily defines it as shorthand for American Indian, the term Indian is more commonly used to describe the people, food, and customs of India, the South Asian country. While the term American Indian has historically been used by both Native-run organizations and the U.S. government, Indian evokes a dark history of negative stereotypes. We've been called Indians an engine to degrade us to a position of inferiority, and that's what we're reminded of when non-natives call us Indian, says Young, adding that the term has been reclaimed within Native communities. Some Natives have also come to use the term Indian country to describe the tribal nations and collective. The NCAI notes that the term Indian country, lowercase c, also appears in U.S. code and is a legal term that's been used in Supreme Court opinions. Again, while Native people can choose to use it at their own discretion, it's one of those things where we're allowed to refer to ourselves in ways others aren't, Young says. Because we've suffered immense trauma at the hands of colonizers and are still suffering from intergenerational trauma, reclaiming terms is the way we cope and heal. Ultimately, if you're unclear on what an Indigenous person prefers to be called, the quickest way to know is to ask them. Our next article by Grant Ridner is titled 16 Famous Native American Actors, Politicians, and Artists Today. There have been great indigenous storytellers, activists, and performers for as long as the various tribes have existed, But as with so many people of color, it has been an uphill battle for many of them to be appreciated on the national and international level. As we finally honor the accomplishments and struggles of indigenous populations, it's more important than ever to have a sense of the contributions famous Native Americans are making today. Even as Native writers like Scott Momaday earned the Pulitzer Prize, and Winona LaDuke made history as a vice presidential nominee, Indigenous people still had to combat stereotypes, a dearth of resources, and smaller platforms than many of their white contemporaries. Finally, many Native Americans and Indigenous people from Canada and Mexico are being properly recognized for the vital work that they're doing. In the world of American politics, Charisse Davids and Deb Haaland are breaking down centuries-old boundaries as the first Native American women to serve in Congress. Jason Momoa helped to diversify the superhero movie genre as Aquaman, and has established himself as a bona fide A-lister in the process. Novelist Tommy Orange made waves with his first book, There There, a New York Times bestseller that consciously combated stereotypes about Native American literature. I feel like for Native writers, there's a kind of burden to catch the general reader up with what really happened, because history has got it so wrong and still continues to, Orange told PALS, and the sentiment is one that likely rings true for Indigenous people in all disciplines. It feels like you want to get everybody on the same page as where your voice is coming from and your experience. The Indigenous community is expansive, with 574 federally recognized tribes in the U.S., 630 in Canada, and more than 17 million Indigenous citizens in Mexico. These 14 famous Native Americans are all doing crucial work in their fields, but by no means are they the only Native names you need to know. Number 1, Jason Momoa, Pawnee, Native Hawaiian. The Aquaman star has talked at length about his background, which includes Native Hawaiian heritage courtesy of his father. He has a shark teeth tattoo on his forearm, which honors his family spirit, and joined protesters trying to protect Mauna Kea, Hawaii's tallest mountain. He's also Pawnee by way of his grandmother and has spoken about wanting to tell more Indigenous stories on screen. There's little to nothing, but that doesn't stop me from wanting to bring justice to a lot of stories and a lot of things people don't know about, he told Rotten Tomatoes. It's what I find interesting, the disenfranchised and people that don't get to tell their story. Number 2, Princess Nokia, Taíno. New York singer and rapper Princess Nokia is a versatile, prolific talent, releasing 2 acclaimed albums in 2020 alone. She's Afro-Indigenous and has Taíno roots, which stem from the Arawak people who lived in the Caribbean and Florida. I am a Yoruba, Taíno, Puerto Rican girl with really brown skin, full curly hair, and a spirit that does not quit. When I hear the drum and speech of my ancestors, I am compelled. I see it and I know it, she told Teen Vogue. Number 3, Irina Bedard, Cree, Inupiaq. Character actress Irene Bedard has been a fixture in Hollywood for more than 2 decades, playing Native American characters on shows like Westworld and Longmire, as well as films such as The New World and The Tree of Life. But Bedard is best known for one of her earliest acting jobs as the voice and physical model for the title character in Disney's hit Pocahontas. Born in Anchorage, Alaska, Bedard's parents are Inupiaq Eskimo and Cree. Number 4, Anthony Kiedis, Mohican. Red Hot Chili Peppers frontman Anthony Kiedis is Mohican by way of his grandmother. You would be forgiven for thinking that he's actually Haida, as he has a large back tattoo of a Haida Thunderbird. In a 2007 interview with People, Kiedis explained that his native heritage helped inspire the name of his daughter, Everly Bear. Number 5, Tommy Orange, Cheyenne Arapaho. Tommy Orange's debut novel, There There, told the story of several Indigenous Americans living in Oakland and their experience with urban life. It was a sensation, making the New York Times bestseller list, earning a prize for Best First Book from the National Book Circle Awards, and a shortlist spot for the Andrew Carnegie Medals. In the novel, he sought to challenge antiquated ideas about being a Native American, as he told Cowboys and Indians. Everything I did in the book that's related to modern technology and contemporary behavior had to do with revisiting the idea of the historical monolithic Native American that everyone thinks of, he said. People think the only real way to be a real Native American is to be historical or have a headdress or look this one way. It's deeply damaging to a people to not have a dynamic range of ways to be that are still acceptable as Native. Number 6, Joy Harjo, Creek, Muskegee. The first Native American poet laureate in U.S. history, Joy Harjo has won acclaim for collections like In Mad Love and War and Secrets from the Center of the World. Harjo has a diverse background and she's been an enrolled member of the Muskegee tribe since age 19. She's been writing since 1973, and her work confronts and dismantles long-held stereotypes around indigenous people. A lot of images of Native Americans are based on fairy tales or Wild West shows. We are human beings, not just people who have been created for people's fantasy worlds. There's not just one Native American, she told Time. We're diverse by community, by land, by language, by culture. Number 7, Tori Amos, Cherokee. With a discography full of platinum and gold plaques, singer-songwriter Tori Amos has been an essential American musician since the early 90s. Her soaring soprano and piano chops are undeniable and have led her to 8 Grammy nominations. Amos has Cherokee heritage on her mother's side, and she told Esquire in 1999 that she comes from very strong women on both sides. Number 8, Sasheen Littlefeather, Apache Yaqui. Actress Sasheen Littlefeather is best known for appearing at the 1973 Academy Awards after Marlon Brando turned down his Best Actor trophy. Littlefeather delivered a poignant, urgent speech about the portrayal of Native Americans in cinema, one that has endured for decades. Beyond that moment, she had a film career of her own and helped create the National American Indian Performing Arts Registry, helping fellow indigenous performers get roles, and even won an Emmy for her involvement with Dancing in America, Song for Dead Warriors. Littlefeather is native on her father's side, hailing from the White Mountain Apache tribe and the Yaqui tribe of Arizona. Number 9, Charisse Davids, Ho-Chunk. Congressperson Charisse Davids has already made plenty of history in her political career. She's one of the first 2 Native American women to be elected to Congress, alongside Deb Haaland, and is also the first LGBTQ person to be elected in Kansas. Davids is part of the Ho-Chunk Nation, which originated in Wisconsin, and she regularly works on projects to help the indigenous population, including boosting economic growth and community development. On a national level, she's worked to protect and expand access to health care, strengthen voter protections, and work to provide more resources to small business owners. Number 10, Deb Haaland, Laguna Pueblo. Another trailblazer, Deb Haaland represents the New Mexico Congressional District containing most of Albuquerque and its suburbs. She's a 35th generation New Mexican and member of the Pueblo of Laguna, a tribe rooted in that region. Haaland has been involved as a sponsor or co-sponsor on legislation to combat environmental pollution, improve the ability to vote by mail, and give indigenous people more autonomy in controlling their tribal lands. I welcome any Indian tribe into my office, whether they're in my district or not, says Haaland. I make sure that any issues they bring to me have a voice. Number 11, Forrest Goodluck, Diné, Mandan, Hidatsa, Temishin. 22-year-old actor Forrest Goodluck has already built himself quite an impressive filmography. He starred opposite Leonardo DiCaprio in The Revenant, has a prominent role in the acclaimed comedy I Used to Go Here, and played a two-spirit character in The Miseducation of Cameron Post. He has a diverse indigenous background. Goodluck is Diné on his father's side and Mandan, Hidatsa, and Temishin on his mother's. Number 12, Kent Mockman, Cree. Kent Mockman has made a stunning career subverting the norms of Western art with his paintings and large-scale installation work. Many of his pieces place indigenous characters in scenes that would usually feature all white faces. Mockman, who is based in Toronto, is part of the Fisher River Cree Nation of the Manitoba area. He self-identifies as both queer and two-spirit, the latter of which means that in their tribes they have a status and specific roles distinct from those given to men or women. Number 13, Lila Downs, Mixtec. Mexican singer-songwriter Lila Downs has been blending traditional music with more contemporary pop stylings for decades, including singing in indigenous languages like Mixtec, Zapotec, Mayan, and Purepecha. Her inventive take on native Mexican music has earned her several Latin Grammys and another Grammy for Best Regional Mexican Music Album on top of that. Downs is of Mixtec origin, hailing from Oaxaca, Mexico. Her 2019 album, Al Chile, honored her native culture as well as the lives of migrants and Mexican women. Number 14, Louise Erdrich, Chippewa. One of the most prolific and acclaimed Native American authors, Louise Erdrich has received two National Book Critics Circle Awards for Love Medicine and La Rose, as well as the Penn Saul Bellow Award for Achievement in American Fiction. In addition to her novels, Erdrich has also written children's fiction, poetry, and several nonfiction collections. Erdrich's grandfather was chairman of the Turtle Mountain Band of the Chippewa in North Dakota, and the writer is a member of that same tribe today. Her book, The Night Watchman, told the story of her grandfather resisting an attempt by Congress to terminate recognition of the Turtle Mountain Band. Number 15, Alyssa Wapanatahk, Cree. The filmography of Alyssa Wapanatahk is relatively brief, but she just landed a major role playing Tiger Lily in Disney's upcoming Peter Pan and Wendy, directed by David Lowery. This just in, so excited for this new journey, she wrote on Instagram when sharing the casting announcement. In addition to her recently announced role, Wapanatahk also wrote and directed the short film The Boy in the Braid, about a young Cree man grappling with his heritage and life in the modern world. She is Cree herself, and her last name translates to First Star in the Sky, or Morning Star. Beyond her film career, Wapanatahk recently started a blog about her life. Number 16, Jimi Hendrix, Cherokee. While groundbreaking guitarist and rock icon Jimi Hendrix died tragically young, we'd be remiss not to include him since his psychedelic tunes continue to earn fans worldwide. He's also one of several foundational rock stars to have Native American ancestry. Hendrix's grandmother was Cherokee, and surviving family has helped make that fact better known. In 2010, many of his belongings were lent to the National Museum of the American Indian. Our next article by Lisa Stardust is titled, How to Use the Moon's Eight Phases to Live Your Best Life. When it comes to astrology, the sun gets a lot of love, but the moon has more control over our lives than we often realize. Every 29 and a half days, the moon completes a full cycle. Each phase, from new moon to full moon, represents a different point in the moon's orbit around the Earth. Whether we're aware of all those waxing and waning crescents or not, the moon's monthly journey affects our personalities, our outlooks, and our lives. By becoming aware of the moon's four main phases and four intermediate stages, we can awaken a new understanding of ourselves and its power. In astrology, the moon governs the realm of subconscious and at times conscious emotions, the part of ourselves which we often can't express but feel on a deep and soulful level. Your moon sign, or the sign and placement the moon was in when you were born, dictates what your inner self needs. But the changing face of the moon in the cosmos affects you on a regular, more tangible basis, too. Why does the moon exert such a strong influence? Think of it like this. The moon controls the tides of the ocean, and we are made of 60% water. We can feel its tugs and movement in everyday life. As a result, moon mapping, or the process of deliberately acting in accordance with the moon cycle, can guide our daily decision making. Each lunar phase is thought to give off a different energy, and we can harness that energy through daily life. Representing beginnings and ends, new moon energy is way different than full moon energy. Since the moon encourages us to look inward, moon mapping is especially important for inner work. Harness the moon's power by setting intentions or guiding goals and principles during each lunar cycle. During the new moon, write a list of what you want to attract, and during the full moon, what you want to let go. Lunar journals, which provide reflective prompts time to phase, are especially helpful. Using the moon's energetic shifts as a blueprint for planning our goals will help us manifest our best lives. After all, whether we're aware of it or not, we're all lunatics, which originally meant lovers of the moon, deep down. Read on for a breakdown of the astrological meaning of the 8 phases of the moon and how they affect us. To make your own moon map, check out the moon calendar to find out when the lunar phases are slated to occur. New moon, also called the dark moon. What is it? The new moon is the first lunar phase of the moon and the easiest to miss. During this phase, the moon comes between the sun and earth and appears to disappear. That's because the moon's shadow side faces the earth, rendering the moon invisible. How do I harness its energy? The new moon is a time of new beginnings and fresh starts. Each new moon, you might want to take the time to set a few personal intentions about what you want to manifest and bring to reality during the upcoming month-long cycle. A few examples: making more money, starting a new relationship, or improving an old one, or bringing a gust of energy into work matters. Now's the time to visualize what we want to achieve, whether in the pages of a diary or a vision board, or jot down findings in your lunar journal. Waxing crescent moon. What is it? The waxing crescent moon occurs right after the new moon. During this phase, the moon appears as a sliver of a crescent. How do I harness its energy? Now that we've decided on what we want to manifest and add to our lives under the new moon, it's time to work toward those intentions. The waxing crescent moon offers a boost of hope and positivity as we embark on our goals for the cycle. Embrace the dreams you imagined for yourself. During the waxing crescent moon, meditate on your desires. First quarter moon. What is it? During the first quarter moon, half of the moon lights up. In the northern hemisphere, the right half is bright, whereas the left half remains dark. How do I harness its energy? With the first quarter moon, we're able to take action in implementing our new moon intentions. Translation: now's the time to make decisions. Use the phase's momentum to overcome any resistance we may face along the way. We can add and change things that need tweaking with our new moon intentions. The universe is allowing us to make edits according to our lifestyle and needs. Waxing gibbous moon. What is it? This phase occurs 2 weeks after the new moon. The moon's vibrant light is expanding and almost full. How do I harness its energy? We can refine and clarify our ideas under this lunar phase. Assessing situations and discussing our feelings is a key focus now, as we are looking inwards and figuring out what we need to change up in our lives. Reciting positive daily affirmations will give us the confidence to evolve and transform during the full moon. Full moon. What is it? This luminary occurs when the Earth finds itself between the Sun and the Moon. The Moon is at its fullest here. How do I harness its energy? Full moons illuminate everything around us, even our intuition. The full moon's glow allows us to see situations and relationships from a clearer perspective. Typically, full moons are a time of letting go and releasing. Now's your chance to quit habits, leave bad situations behind, and focus on healing. There are many rituals associated with the full moon, like charging crystals and taking a relaxing bath to unwind and be in flow with the universe. After all, we are honoring the moon in all its glory now. One final heads up: interpersonal relationships can become more intense during this lunar phase. More so than not, relationships can evolve and grow if both parties are willing to leave past issues and squabbles behind. We can start anew under a full moon if we're willing to change. Waning gibbous moon. What is it? Right after the full moon, the moon begins to dim its light. How do I harness its energy? We're over halfway through the moon cycle. How far have we come in the intentions we set during the new moon? The waning gibbous moon is a time to take stock, including revisiting those intentions. Expressing gratitude is essential now. Try writing a letter to the universe and owning your power. Last quarter moon. What is it? Sometimes called the third quarter, half of the moon lights up during this lunar phase, the opposite of the first quarter moon. How do I harness its energy? Think of the last quarter moon as a lunar spring cleaning. Time to clean out that which no longer serves us, whether it be burdensome projects, toxic relationship dynamics, or even those sweaters we never wear. We're coming to the realization that we have released in order to evolve. And yes, now's the time to clean our houses too. Give our mind a final cleanse through regular meditation. If you're looking for justice, this is a time when karma will come full circle. Cord cutting on bad habits can have effective results if done during this lunar phase. Waning crescent moon, also called the balsamic moon. What is it? The moon is back to being a sliver with only a crescent of the left side visible. How do I harness its energy? This is the last lunar phase before a new cycle begins. Therefore, it's a time when we need to be still and at peace. Instead of pushing ourselves to the limit, we should rest, focus, and reflect. Find peace before starting the new journey that's coming our way in a few days. Now that we've completed the whole lunar cycle, we can look back at the highs and lows of the past weeks to understand the lessons that the moon has brought to our attention. At the end of the moon cycle, take a crystal bath with flowers and Epsom salt. Get ready because we're about to start the lunar journey all over again. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Why Doesn't the Crown Show How Princess Margaret Helped Create Modern Astrology? Quick, guess the zodiac sign of Princess Margaret, Queen Elizabeth's chain-smoking dilettante of a younger sister. Born on August 21st, Princess Margaret was a quintessential Leo, but she was also cursed with a Leo's worst nightmare. Though Margaret craved attention and spotlight, she was forced to take a back seat to her more subdued, yet more essential, older sister, Queen Elizabeth. As it happens, the fact that we're so familiar with Princess Margaret's sun sign in the first place is thanks to the royal herself. In fact, there wouldn't even be a modern horoscope system based on sun signs without the birth of Princess Margaret. Now that's a sentence that would warm an attention-loving Leo's heart. 3 days after Princess Margaret was born, astrologer R.H. Naylor predicted that she would have an eventful life in a column called What the Stars Foretell for the New Princess, published by the Sunday Express on August 24, 1930. Everybody is interested in the future. Can it be told by the stars? The column began, introducing readers to a novel concept, the horoscope. Naylor's influential column came about after John Gordon, the Sunday Express's editor, was stumped about how to cover yet another royal birth. Initially, Gordon reached out to Shero, real name William John Warner, a famous astrologer who had previously told the fortunes of public figures like Oscar Wilde, Thomas Edison, and Margaret's uncle Edward VIII. In a fateful twist, Shero wasn't available for the column, but his assistant, R.H. Naylor, was. To be fair, Naylor's first proclamation about the newly born princess's eventful life rings less like divination, more like fact. Margaret was born a princess in a castle, after all, an inherently eventful start to a life. Beyond that underwhelming statement, however, Naylor's first column exhibited some undeniable and slightly spooky prescience. First, Naylor guessed that Margaret would grow up to show a scorn of restraint, which might explain why she's depicted kissing President Lyndon B. Johnson in The Crown. But most shockingly, Naylor also guessed that events of tremendous importance to the royal family and the nation will come about near Margaret's seventh year. Naylor was a year off, but still impressively close to the event that would send the royal family reeling. In 1936, when the princess was just six, King Edward VIII abdicated the throne of England to marry Wallis Simpson, a divorced socialite. Margaret quickly went from being another privileged princess to being the younger sister of the future queen. Was this a lucky guess? Or was Naylor a pioneer in the medium of horoscopes? Depends on your thoughts about astrology. What is certain is that with his Sunday Express column, Naylor was on his way to making the concept of sun signs a touchstone for people's identities. The article about Princess Margaret's future was a smash hit with readers. Following that success, Naylor was hired by the Sunday Express to write two weekly columns, one predicting future world events and one with predictions for that week's birthdays. A month later, he cemented his abilities as a mystic when he prophesied that a British aircraft would be in danger between October 8th and the 15th. Lo and behold, on October 5th, an R-101 airship crashed in France, killing 48 people. With that, an iconic astrologer was born. Naylor began writing a weekly column in the Sunday Express called Your Stars, an early version of the horoscope predictions based on your sun sign that millions of people now read daily, whether it's in the newspaper or apps like CoStar, the most popular astrology app in the Apple Store. Soon after Naylor, other newspapers were hiring astrologers of their own. To modern-day renowned astrologer Susan Miller, all culture's current surge of interest in astrology is evidence of a broader pattern in human behavior. People have always loved astrology, she says. Now all these reporters are calling me asking why millennials are interested and why we're having a resurgence, but there's never been a resurgence. We're just talking about astrology now, that's all. But long before the internet, Naylor was faced with a challenge. Of course, he didn't have time to generate 365 custom daily predictions to answer his 28,000 daily letters the way he once did for Princess Margaret, so he set about devising a simplified system from an ancient practice. Craig Brown, Margaret's biographer, describes Naylor's process in his excellent book, 99 Glimpses of Princess Margaret. He divided 360-degree transit into 12 zones, each of them spanning 30 degrees. He then named each of the 12 zones after a different celestial constellation and offered blocks of predictions for each birth sign. Translation: Naylor essentially created the personality profiles we now associate with our zodiac signs, 12 archetypes associated with personality traits. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, Jessica Dore Thinks You Can Change Your Life with a Tarot Card. Jessica Dore wants to let you in on a secret. Many, actually. Through her work as a licensed social worker and tarot reader, Dore believes she was granted access to powerful ideas, the kind that can transform a person's life. Now she's made it her mission to share the secrets with others and perhaps spark personal change. To do so, Dore pairs the 78 cards of the tarot with ideas from psychology, mythology, and literature, as well as evidence-based research. While tarot can be used for multiple purposes, from divination to decision-making, Dore's interest in the cards is purely secular, intended to spark insights and even more questions. Maybe knowing isn't the sign of waking up, maybe wondering is, she wrote on Instagram, where she has amassed a large following thanks to her sharp, wise, tarot-inspired meditations, which borrow from a wealth of sources, from philosophy books to therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy, or CBT, and acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT. Her new book, Tarot for Change, Using the Cards for Self-Care, Acceptance, and Growth, expands on a format she perfected on Twitter and Instagram. I see this as a self-help book illustrated with tarot cards. I'm using Pamela Coleman Smith's art in the Rider Smith Waite Tarot to try to understand the human experience, Dore tells Oprah Daily. In the book, Dore offers up thoughtful life lessons inspired by the symbols and historical meaning of each card. As an example, the Fool, the tarot's first card and the first entry in the book, Dore introduces a story from the Seneca tribe about dancing, the psychological concept of rule-governed behavior, the work of Latvian poet Robert Avens, and the myth of the Green Man represented in Aleister Crowley's Thought Tarot, all for a moving essay on rules and how and why to break them. While rules create structure in our lives, Dorr says, they also can freeze us into a state of rigidity. By having the courage to break internal rules, to change, we may be freeing ourselves from patterns. It goes on. The entry for the Moon card is about the power of being in a state of not knowing. The Three of Cups card uses tenets from dialectical behavior therapy, or DBT, to make a case for supporting loved ones in times of joy as well as times of sadness. The book is the latest stop on Dorr's winding and unconventional path, blending tarot, psychology, and storytelling. In an early chapter, she calls Tarot for Change a book of secrets that she gathered from her years walking the perimeters of two fields that hold powerful technologies for transformation and growth. Dorr was first introduced to tarot by her mother, also a social worker. As a kid, she felt her mom was always trying to get up in her business with the cards and shied away from starting her own practice. Then came a fateful dinner party in 2011 when Dorr got a reading from an acquaintance. I was going through some things. I felt so seen by the cards, held by them. I was like, this is giving me something to hold on to. I've been obsessed with tarot since that day, she says. When that journey began, Dorr was working as a publicist and later an editor at New Harbinger, a psychology and self-help publishing house based in Oakland, and publisher of The Untethered Soul, one of Oprah's favorites. Dorr saw an overlap between learnings from her job and her daily card pulls. Both therapy and a good tarot reading, she argues, can help a person get unstuck. You might go to therapy if you feel like your life has become unmanageable or if you're caught and you feel like you can't see your way through. Tarot is similar. I get people who come and are having big life questions and wanting a little bit of guidance and support for how to get through, she says. However, she notes that tarot should not be used as a substitute for therapy with a qualified professional. On each page, Tarot for Change offers a lesson for how to get through using the proven mechanics of behavior change and the tarot's mysteries. Below, Dorr told us how she nimbly wove a tapestry of ideas you're liable to return to again and again. How do you explain tarot to people who know nothing about it? If I had the choice, I would not explain it to anyone who wasn't interested. In the book, I talk about my experience with yoga practice, which is another long tradition that has other spiritual secrets stuck inside. My teacher didn't want to talk about it. He just said, do it. Do it every day for 10 years. If you have questions, then we can talk about it. I feel that way about tarot. Get a deck, pull cards, interact with the images. Don't make it into a big story. It doesn't have to be a spiritual practice or have an ideology. It can just be a set of images. You can see what happens. Bring it down to the basics if you can. That's how I would talk about it with people. It's a set of 78 pieces of art, like you'd go to a museum. What do you notice? What's the mood? What does it activate in you? There are many ways to interact with a tarot deck and with your book. How should we read your book? I imagined in my fantasy that it'll be a similar companion to 78 Degrees of Wisdom by Rachel Pollack. When you're learning the card, you'll turn to the page. There are so many good interpretations online, but for me as a book person, there's something about having a book as an object that you bring around with you and develop a relationship with. The meat of the book is 78 interpretations of the cards. They're very open-ended, but they might give you some quotes and visuals that might help in your own interpreting. I wanted to demonstrate to people what it looks like to interact with the cards. This is me interacting with the cards in a process-oriented and open-ended way. I'm not reducing it to, this is what it means. I'm saying, this is what came up for me. Maybe it helps you in what comes up for you. When you started at New Harbinger, you were intrigued by the secrets found in the psychology books. You write tarot has secrets, too. How much of this was you trying to give people tools to things or ideas they didn't have access to? I thought a lot about this. For a long time, my assumption about accessibility was that it had to do with money, geography, and the material resources to go to therapy. Matt McKay, who founded New Harbinger, was a therapist in Haight-Ashbury in the 70s, and he was like, there are people who need help and we can't do individual therapy with everyone. Why don't we start a publishing company and start disseminating these ideas more broadly? That's how this company got started. That makes a lot of sense. There's another piece of accessibility. What makes things soluble? For a lot of the ideas I find in self-help books or psychology books, the language that is used doesn't cut it. The way that things are said does nothing for me. I don't feel anything. It's technical and clinical. It doesn't resonate. Similarly, with tarot, if you don't immediately resonate with images in the tarot cards or have an idea of what tarot is or is supposed to be, that makes it an inaccessible tool. You think that it's only fortune-telling. What's interesting for me is that when you pair those things together, these psychological ideas and the images in the tarot, now all of a sudden they become soluble. When dietitians speak about how certain vitamins need fat in order for it to absorb, that's what this reminds me of. For years, you worked in psychology and self-help publishing. Is your intent with this book also to help people change their lives? Some of the ideas in the book are ideas that can change your life. They come from evidence-based sources, cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance commitment therapy. There's a lot of evidence and research. I'm not presenting those therapies in the book, but I am presenting ideas from them that do help people. I wanted to expose people to the names of these things like emotion regulation and distress tolerance. If the ID feels powerful to you, you can follow up. It's hard as a layperson who doesn't know anything about what kinds of therapy there are to know what you might need. That's one thing that's cool about the book. It talks about a lot of different things and you can follow up. It's a taste. It's not a workbook or an evidence-based book. It's a jack-of-all-trades and master-of-none project. Do you have any tips for people who read this book and ask, what do I do next? How can I start interacting with these cards to spark my own thoughts, revelations, changes? Get a tarot deck. Search the tarot hashtag on Instagram. You can see a lot of different art for different decks. It's important to choose a deck that you really love and feel seen by, validated by, and you feel it speaks a language that you either can understand or see yourself learning to understand. Don't be afraid to take your time to find art that you really like, and then invest in a deck. I picked a card every night and every morning and would journal about it. I would look up some of the meanings on the internet and had a book. I just liked, when I started, the structure of having that 20 minutes a day every day where it was just checking in with myself, using the cards as a tool. That's how it started for me. You don't have to make any connections. You don't have to know what they mean. You don't have to become a tarot reader. You can just see it as a time to connect with yourself, pull a card, and look up the meaning and see if anything resonates for you. It's a tool that can make you feel seen. That's not always as common as you think. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled The Beginner's Guide to Reading Tarot Cards According to the Pros. Lately, my mornings have undergone a subtle but transformative revolution. Instead of doom scrolling on my phone like I used to, I reach for my tarot deck and pull a card. Even though I'm still a beginner, reading the tarot, specifically Rachel True's new deck, has become an essential part of my morning routine. There is absolutely a difference in my day when I sit down with the tarot and spend some time with myself before the craziness kicks in. Memorist Michelle T., who also wrote Modern Tarot, tells OprahMag.com. T. also appreciates the tarot as a piece of art that echoes back through the centuries. Technically speaking, the tarot is a set of 78 decorated cards that dates back to the 15th century. The cards initially were used in Europe as a game and only gained a mystical connotation in the 18th century. The deck is divided into the major arcana, 22 cards that represent major themes in a person's life, and the minor arcana, which represent everyday events. The minor arcana is subdivided into four suites, each containing 10 cards and four court cards. But you'll find out about this when you start using your first deck. Ultimately, actress and reader Rachel True says these cards are pieces of paper. The magic and beauty and power of the tarot cards is their ability to help you unlock your own personal power, she says. Learning the meaning of all 78 cards, not to mention reversals, can be daunting, but any beginner can start on the journey. Tarot is for everyone because everybody has an intuition. Tarot is a way to connect to that, psychic medium Michael Cardenas says. Tarot reader Aaron Colfage agrees, telling OprahMag.com, You can get a good reading just from the images of the deck without being psychic at all. The symbols can open another way of looking at the world. OpenMag.com spoke to multiple professional tarot readers to learn their tips and tricks. While each pro offered their own version of Tarot 101, they all agreed that the journey is a personal one. Read their advice, then discover what works for you. Pick a tarot deck that speaks to you. The first step, of course, is procuring a tarot deck, and there are many options. Do you go for the nature imagery of the popular and modern Wild Unknown deck? Or the Tarot de Marseille deck, one of the oldest in existence? Or break out a deck of playing cards with each corresponding to a tarot card? Beginners may want to start with the influential Rider-Waite-Smith deck, first published in 1909, as its artwork inspired many later iterations. Psychic medium and tarot reader Sarah Potter recommends researching the deck's artwork on sites like Athletic Tarot prior to buying, since the design conveys the card's significance. Being able to connect with the imagery is so important. Select a deck that you find yourself in and offers the right mirror, she says. She also dispels a long-held myth that people shouldn't buy their own decks. Go ahead and buy your own. You can use books, but make your own meanings too. Got your deck? Great. Now it's time to become acquainted with the cards. Luckily, you're not on your own. There is an abundance of information about the tarot on the internet and bookstores. Further, most decks come with guidebooks that interpret the deck's particular artwork. That said, professional tarot readers recommend trusting yourself above all the supplemental material. Make your own meaning. As a first step, Luna recommends writing a journal entry for each card. Sit with each card first. Write out your thoughts and impressions and see how they align with the book's interpretation, she says. For astrologer and tarot reader Lexi Ferguson, the process of learning the cards is never-ending. Don't ever assume you have the final answer about each card. Just because you read it in one little book doesn't mean there's an ultimate answer for cards. The beauty of it is there are always more layers, she says. After becoming acquainted with the cards, start doing readings for yourself and others. Learning the cards' meanings is the first step. Putting them in conversation is the next one. According to T, doing readings for yourself, others, or even imaginary friends is the only way to learn. The art of reading tarot is connecting the cards, not only remembering what each card means, but gaining deeper intuition and understanding about the way that they would influence each other in a spread, T says. Ferguson compares tarot to speaking a language. You can only take so many classes. You have to jump in, and that's how you're going to get fluent, Ferguson says, adding that if reading for others, you should inform them you're a beginner. Ironically, doing readings for yourself can sometimes be even more complicated than doing readings for others. What's challenging is remaining unbiased, Potter says. Before doing a reading for yourself, be open-minded to whatever comes through. Visit other readers as well. Majorca-based tarot reader Caitlin McGarry recommends consulting other readers as well. There are so many ways of interpreting cards when you arrange them with other cards. Going to different readers can help you see that, McGarry says. When it comes to readings, choose your question wisely. Before pulling the cards for a particular spread, you'll need to formulate a question. Think about your intentions for the reading and what you really want to know about your love life, career, family drama, or wherever else you're seeking clarity. Crafting effective tarot questions is an art of its own. Ferguson recommends starting questions with the word how or what instead of will, and avoiding simple yes or no questions entirely. In this way, Ferguson says, you can inject agency into your reading and have a hand in creating your own future. It gives you something actionable. Instead of just sitting around waiting to see if the tarot was right, you could actually do something to make change in your life, she says. Shuffle the cards until you're ready. While shuffling the cards, meditate on the question you're asking. There are multiple shuffling techniques. Spread the cards out in front of you, shuffle them casino style, or hold the deck in one hand and use the other to shift chunks from one side to the other. Do whatever feels right, Potter says. I recommend closing your eyes, taking a deep breath, and clearing your mind. As for when to stop, Similarly, Potter says to trust your intuition. Sense a theme? I just know when the cards are thoroughly mixed and ready, she says. If you're doing a reading for another person, you can also have them shuffle. I like people putting their energy into the cards, T says. Or Ferguson suggests a compromise between the two. She shuffles, and her client cuts the deck into three piles, selecting one. Just as there are methods for shuffling, there are as many options for cutting the deck. Ultimately, how you divide the deck comes down to intuition. Be sure to pick a spread like the Celtic cross before you shuffle the cards. When using a tarot spread, each chosen card will correspond to a certain position, like past, present, and future. Ferguson emphasizes the importance of picking a spread prior to dealing the cards. You need the context of the spread to have meaning. Beginners may gravitate toward one-card readings or three-card readings, like past, present, future, opportunities, challenges, outcomes, and mind, body, spirit. The 10-card Celtic cross is also a popular spread, giving a more comprehensive look at a certain question. There are boundless ideas for spreads to be found online and in books. By repeating the same spread daily, you may glean deeper insights. True recalls the summer she pulled a Celtic cross spread daily to illuminating results. I would draw a diagram for the Celtic cross every day. After a month, you start to see things like, oh my goodness, I keep getting the Justice card in the same position all the time, or I keep getting the Justice card, but it's moving around the spread. You can read reverse tarot cards or ignore them, your call. Ah, reversals. We have arrived at one of the most debated topics in tarot. Here's the long and short of it. If you choose to read reversals, you're going to have to learn another 78 meanings. When a card falls in a spread in reverse, it's most often a modified meaning of its upright position meaning, Blue June, a professional tarot reader, tells OprahMag.com. Still, June recommends placing the reversals in context of the story of the spread. One common mistake is to go straight to the opposite meaning, but it's not usually so black and white. This is where intuition comes in, she says. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.